Hello, my name is Jean Odom. My age is 77, and today it is Sunday, March the 6th, 2022. I'm located in Pensacola, Florida, that beautiful city, and the name of my interviewing partner is my only son, Johnny Odom.
And I'm Johnny Odom. I'm currently 43 years old. Here on Sunday, March 6, 2022, we are in Pensacola, Florida, and I'm talking today with my beloved mother, Jean Odom, and we're going to talk about our time in Tennessee, in Memphis. So I'll go ahead and start out, Mom. My first memories are when we lived in Coronado in California, but I was born in Memphis. I actually was born in Millington, but I always say Memphis. When we were stationed there, because Dad was in the Navy. And I don't remember much of that. I saw most of it later on when I went with Dad and Uncle Eugene on a trip up there that they took a few years ago. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the time in Memphis, and I'd like to start with a story from a couple of weeks before I was even conceived, which is when Elvis died and how you got to see him.
Well, I remember it well, not just because Elvis died, but the day before, it was my birthday on the 17th of August, and he passed away on the 16th. The officers' wives at the Memphis Naval Air Station, they decided that they wanted to take me to lunch in the officers' club. So there were four of us, and during that lunch, they had the TV on because of Elvis dying in Memphis. Well, out at Millington, it's about a 35-minute drive down to where Elvis lived. And so during the conversation, Penny, who was a vice admiral's wife, and incidentally 6 months pregnant, which is important to the story, she decided to say to us, why don't we get in the car after lunch and go down, because the boulevard, Elvis Presley Boulevard, was still open to traffic.
Had you passed Graceland very much before then?
I'd been to Graceland, yes, beforehand, just as a tourist that was living in Memphis at the time. So it was the centerpiece of Memphis. And I'd also been on a talk show that we did for PBS, raising funds, and Elvis called in that night to donate. So I was aware of his fame in that area.
Had you been in Memphis long at that point? Had it been a year, 2 years?
I just can't remember how long it was when I was there. So that was interesting that he did pass away while I was there.
So you all piled into a car and you headed down there.
Yeah, we headed down to Memphis. And chit-chatting on the way about the crowds that had gathered overnight, they had reportedly been 100,000 that were lining the streets, not only on the boulevard, but the streets that were spanning off the boulevard. So we arrive down where the house is, and just past the house on the right, there was a small strip mall that had about 6 shops in it. And to our luck, a car just happened to pull out. So Penny whipped in there, got that parking spot, and we all jumped out and figured out what we should do.
And I can actually tell you, I know exactly where that strip mall is, because when we went to see Graceland with Uncle Eugene and Dad, it's still there. It's been bought by Graceland, and they've actually converted the little gas station there into another part of all the exhibits. And they've actually got Elvis's plane next to it. So it was really strange to see that it hadn't changed since then. It just is now part of the whole museum, the whole Graceland experience.
Well, that is interesting. Well, what happened next was we decided that we would cross the traffic and get onto the Meridian and just walk down to where the gates of Graceland were. So dodging the traffic was really dangerous, but we did get onto the Meridian. We walked down, got to where Graceland was, and just as we arrived there, an ambulance came out. For the ambulance to come out, the gates had to open, and the crowds had to be pushed back onto the roadside, literally, because they were probably about 20 feet in depth. And so all these crowds are piling onto the road and eventually reaching us on the Meridian. Well, at that point, four police horses came behind us, and the gentleman on the police horses said, "Ladies, move forward." Well, we looked at the police horses and said, "We're not quite sure that we can do that. We need to leave. We didn't come to sightsee." And you don't argue with four police horses, because then the policeman got a little tougher and said, "Ladies, move forward." So we were pushed into the crowd, and lo and behold, we are the first ones up against the gates. So at this point, Pen is 6 months pregnant, and we're panicking a little and trying to surround her because the crowds were packed in like sardines. So we said to people around, "Could you please let us out?" Well, nobody wanted to give up their spot. So here we are, stuck at the front of the gates and just wondering what we were going to do, when his father came down, Vernon Presley, and opened the gate and said, "First 20, coming inside." So we're kind of astonished and looking at each other with wide open eyes, and we stepped inside and started to walk up the pathway, and there were bouquets of flowers, and there were flowers all decorated in blue suede shoes or guitars as we walked up. So when we got to the steps of the house, there was a color guard being changed, and it was from the army, which of course Elvis served, and the policemen. And of course, Elvis was an honorary policeman in Memphis, Tennessee, which was a big deal. So we watched the color guard, and we're standing there, and we've got our hands literally over our chest, just kind of half saluting, not quite knowing what to do, because all of a sudden we're part of this ceremony. When that was completed, we stepped up, and the coffin was kind of in the foyer. And I couldn't exactly tell you what the foyer looked like or anything, because we're still in a stunned state of disbelief. It was surreal. But Elvis is laid out in the coffin, and three quarters of it was covered in these beautiful tiny roses that were spilling down the side. He was head and shoulders with arms crossed, to my memory. Now, other people will probably give different scenarios of what they see, but in my sight, this was this enormous man, and I mean enormous, not being fat, but a gigantic man. He was a big man laying there. He had jet black hair, and his eyelashes looked like two butterflies. That was the impression that I'm looking at. And again, in your mind, it's surreal. You can't really think it's happening. You can't take it in. And behind were stood several people. One of them was Vernon. Another was his stepmother. And then there was Colonel Parker. I'm not quite sure who else I spoke to, but we gave our condolences as we passed along the front of the coffin. And behind, there was a staircase. And again, the logistics of this hallway, you're trying to take everything in. But I just remember all these children with ice cream cones. And they're just sitting there licking the ice cream cones. So I'm assuming that his daughter was there, and that the friends of his daughter, which were the friends of Elvis that lived in the complex, they were all the children. But nobody told us exactly who they were. Once we'd done that surveillance, which it seemed in my memory to be, because, again, it's so surreal, and we stepped down and back into the open area, and as we're stepping down, that's when the Associated Press took over. And on the way out, they're interviewing us. Why are we here? Where do we come from? So I was never a big Elvis fan. I loved Elvis. I thought he was great. But I liked Everly Brothers and several other pop idols at that time. So
And you grew up in Morecambe in England, right when the British invasion was happening. So you danced to the Beatles in the cavern, and you fixed a tire for the Rolling Stones and a few other things. So you were, in a way, sort of used to all of this rock and roll going on in your culture. So Elvis was just another part of that, in a way.
Yes, that is correct, because in my hometown, there were 25 live theaters, small ones from 50 capacity up to several thousand. So I was used to that kind of thing, and used to groups that were just making it or had made it come into our hometown. And so it wasn't anything unusual for me. But to be confronted was, did you like Elvis? Yes, I really liked him. But instead, I chose to talk about my best friend, Maris. We were born 3 months apart, still best friends to this day. But Maris would lean on the jukebox, wherever there was a jukebox, put on Elvis's songs and just cry. And she'd cry and cry and cry. She just loved Elvis. We were teenagers, or she was a teenager at that time, listening to his music. So I related to the press how my best friend loved and adored Elvis, and I was here to represent her. It was like it was all planned and not the accident of being pushed up against the gates. Well, fast forward to getting back to Millington. So that evening, my husband was on duty in a specific area on the base. There were no cell phones back then, and our telephone had to be not off the hook, which was important to us because we were trying hard not to leave it off the hook, because every few minutes the press were calling. Somebody had got the number, they're calling to see what my interest was in Elvis, and so it went on.
And Dad's waiting for a call in case he has to be on duty, or in case he has to be called in on the duty that he's on.
Correct, yes. So again, we couldn't leave the phone off the hook. The next day in the newspaper in my hometown, it was the first time that I recall any color being in the paper.
And that was the Morecambe Visitor.
That was the Morecambe Visitor, yeah. Yes. And I was interviewed. I'm not quite sure whether it was Associated Press or there were so many press people there. But what I was interviewed about was actually put on the front page of the Visitor. And it was bordered in purple. And that's what stuck in my mind was, wow, we got colour in the Visitor. So that was really interesting to me. The way it was relayed out in print, it sounded like I was the lady that had discovered him in the bathroom when he had passed away. It's they didn't say that. It's just the impression that I was closer to the situation
than I was.
An eyewitness, yeah. So, and it probably doesn't read that way today. It's just taking everything in those few days.
It was the naval base at Millington has changed a lot since then. Back then, it was the head of training for all the Navy. And in fact, I think all that training's been moved here to Pensacola. Now it's the head of the, now it's for the human resources in the Navy. It's a lot smaller. It's a lot quieter. Do you remember the other Pensacola connection that they used to have where they would take the jets down to, from Millington down to Pensacola and
go to Joe Paddy's? I think everybody on the base wanted to be able to be a friend of somebody that was flying one of those planes, because everybody was on the tarmac with their coolers waiting for that shrimp to come out of Joe Paddy's when they got back. Big event. We love Joe Paddy's shrimp. And so anybody that knew anybody that was flying, they were hoping they could get their coolers filled.
Put a bunch of coolers on the planes, and then when they flew back, it was enough time that it would still be okay. When I went up with Dad, a couple of interesting things happened. The first was the Methodist Church up there, the Fellowship Hall, is named after the minister who was there when we were there. And I don't remember him, but I remember his name. And Dad said, wow, it sure has grown up around here. And there's still almost nothing there, so I can't imagine what it was like back when I was, you know, 1 year old. I also went to the hospital where I was born, and it's no longer a naval hospital. They've shut it down, but it's almost ghostly because the University of Tennessee has bought it, and so it's this abandoned naval hospital about 15 stories or something high. And in addition to sort of being very abandoned-looking, it's also a lot like the hospital here in Pensacola. You almost want to find out who the architect was back then to see if they were all designed by the same firm or how they were made. What do you remember of that hospital when it was, you know, fully active?
Well, I remember a funny story, and Dr. Christian was in charge when I unfortunately started having a miscarriage. And he sent me home, and the other doctor that was with him, he decided that I needed to come back in. So I came back in, and then they put me on bed rest for several months.
Oh, and well, this was when you were pregnant with me?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the funny story was, I went into the hospital and ready to deliver you, and a doctor that was seeing to me came in, and he sat by my bedside, and he was reading the paper. And he was looking at the monitor, and he kept tapping the monitor, and he looking again, tapping the monitor. And he eventually said, "Jean, are you having this baby? Because this monitor is registering it." And I said, "Yes," like this. And he looks at me, and he calls the orderlies in, and he examined me, and he said, "Orderly, get this bed down to the delivery room now." And what had happened during the evening, unbeknownst to me, I was going in labor, but I didn't think it was to that extent. And just as I was about to call for a nurse, a lady down the hallway was screaming, and I heard this almighty bang, and the screaming stopped. So I assumed somebody had slapped her. I don't think they had, but that was my assumption. So I, in my head, I'm going, "I'm not making a sound. I'm not going to make a sound." Fast forward to the orderly coming in, grabbed the bed, ran down the hallway, rushed me into the delivery room, and of course, that's when you became present.
And so how premature was I?
Pardon?
How premature was I?
You were 3 months premature.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. You were very, very a miracle baby. Everybody been praying after you because of all the months I've been in bed at home. And the senator for Tennessee at that time used to be
part of the state senate, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And he was Leonard Donovan. He was my choir master at church, small church. And he would bring the choir over and sing outside my window. They'd just sing, and it was just a wonderful family event at that church. It was just breathtaking to know that you were in their hands and in God's care. So another incident I remember happened. We were going to the Aaron Copland concert, and opposite where the venue was, there was a big convention center. And this particular Sunday afternoon, there was an African-American Baptist ladies event at the conference center. And as we pulled up to the traffic lights, all these ladies came out, and they were wearing wonderful hats, fur stoles, all kinds of finery. I mean, they looked tip-top church-going ladies.
And in England, everybody still wore a hat back
everybody
then.
Still wore a hat. And I was really upset because I couldn't find any hats. And I'd left all my hats in England to friends. "Can I have this hat? Can I have that hat?" So the transition of not being able to wear a hat at church, because they were out of vogue at that time. So I jumped out of the car and I rushes into this crowd that's crossing in front of our car. And I'm saying to all these ladies, "Where do you get your hats? Where do you get your hat?" And they're looking at me with big, wide open eyes like, "What is this lady here?" And eventually one lady told me, and I got back in the car, and I told my husband, "This is where I want to go." So a couple of nights later, we drove down there. Now, I was unaware because of the Martin Luther King assassination down there that it was off limits, the area that we were going into. So it's dark, and we drive down there, and they were like row houses. Now, I can't describe them because, again, in my memory, it was a long, long time ago.
And when we went back, Dad said that as famous as Beale Street is now and as touristy as it is, members of the Navy or sailors were not allowed on Beale Street.
That's right.
It was against orders.
Well, the beautiful memory of this was in the center of all these row houses was a house that had been converted into a shop. And so I got out of the car and went to the door. And as I opened it, a little bell tinkled, little bell on the door. And I went in, and there was this amazing little room, and it had just a few hats, but three area stations that you could sit at to try a hat on. And there were three ladies, and two ladies were assisting them and putting hats on their head. Again, this was an African-American ladies that were sitting there. And another lady came through a door on the opposite side of the room, and all of them sat there or stood there with their mouths wide open and looking at me. And I'm looking back at them, and I'm trying to see the hats. And I had an auntie that had been a milliner in England, so it was really fascinating to me. But we all just stared at each other, nobody saying a word. And then eventually I said, I came to buy a hat. And nobody answered me. And then the lady that was standing said, well, I'm awfully sorry, but this little shop only does made to order, because they were milliners. And I almost filled up in tears. I just stood there and looked there. But they all gave me a nice smile and wished me a good evening, and off I went back in the car. So that was a nice experience in itself, just to see this cottage industry of a milliner displaying and selling her wares. I thought that was beautiful.
So, and you did some theater in Memphis. How long was it to get from Millington? How did the logistics work getting from Millington down to Memphis and back for that? You were part of the theater in the square at the time?
Theater, yes. I think it was the square or in the round, in the square. But the theater logistically from the base was about 45 minutes drive. So one night I was down there and ice storms come in Memphis. In fact, I used to love taking you out into the woods that were behind the Navy base. And as a tiny baby, I'd hold you. And when a leaf, a branch cracked on a tree, you'd spin your head to one side. And then it would crack on another tree because of the weight of the ice. And I'm thinking, well, there's nothing wrong with his hearing. That's wonderful. But the ice storms would just come in, and you literally could not see the ice. It was black ice on the road. So I'd never experienced this before.
You had snow in England, but not this kind of ice.
Not to that extent. And I grew up around the English Lake District, but I never experienced black shot ice. So I go out to my car, to the car, and I had a big, big old-fashioned station wagon. And it held
wood paneling.
Pardon?
Right. Wood paneling, right?
Wood paneling.
I remember that very well.
Yes, because in California, I would take all my neighbor's kids and pile them in the car, and we'd go up to Julian for a bakery that did breads from all over the world and take them back. So it was a well-traveled car.
That could sit about seven people, couldn't it?
It seated six in the back because they faced each other, and then there was another seat.
The seats, the trunk, had seats where you could fold them out, right?
Yes, and they faced each other. So it was a very big car, very popular with the kids.
And then how many total could fit in that car?
9 or 10, yeah. So all seat belted.
Minivan in the it was like a sedan, but you could carry as many people as a minivan, basically.
A big gas guzzler. And the funny thing is, we sold that car and bought a smaller car several years later.
Here in Pensacola?
Yes. And then it went out to California, And then the guy that took it out to California sold it, and we saw it again when it came back to Pensacola.
So it went from Tennessee to California, California to Pensacola, Pensacola to California, California back to Pensacola.
It did, yeah. An amazing little car. And it belonged to a farmer's wife, and it only had about 30,000 miles on it when we bought it. And so it had over 200 and some thousand miles the last time we saw it.
Well, so that part of Tennessee is also almost part of Arkansas, right? It's
yes.
Really farm country. And you would go out to the auctions, right?
I love the auctions because in England, I've never been to an auction where they're going, blah, 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 sold to the lady in the front, blah, 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 basket to that lady over there. So I used to like going, just bidding a few dollars on the boxes. Never knew what was in the boxes. It was just a surprise. And I actually bought our first dining set table and hutch from a place in Arkansas, a little village out in Arkansas. And that traveled around with us to California and down here to Pensacola, and then we sold that. But it came from Arkansas. Gorgeous, gorgeous villages and scenery. It was beautiful.
You lived for a time on a farm in England, and this was your first time in the States really seeing farms. How different were the farms from what you were used to in the Lake District and in Lancashire?
Well, the farms in England were full of hedgerows. So they were fields that were divided by hedgerows with all the rabbits and Beatrix Potter, literally. Little birds' nests and everything. And we learned how to build a hedge and how to cut it enough to be able to do that.
Dry stone walling?
And stone walling, yeah. The 4-H over here would have done stone walling from the slate, from the Lake District. And that slate, incidentally, is the same that was built by the house in Bellingrath Gardens in Mobile. The owner was very rich, and his wife had liked the slate in England, so they brought it over from the Lake District and built the home in Bellingrath Gardens. So
we have the naval training goes from Millington to Pensacola, and
yeah.
Even when it was in Millington, you're going back and forth with the jets, yeah. And the Joe Paddies, and then from where you're from in England, all the slate comes over to Mobile next to Pensacola. So and the car goes back and forth between California and Pensacola. So all these things are kind of linked together, especially to the Pensacola area. The dry stone walling, that's a different kind of stone wall though, right? What's special about that?
Well, there's limestone walling, and that comes from the quarries surrounding where I lived in Morecambe, Lancaster. So when you do dry stone walling, there's no cement involved. And it's like building a jigsaw puzzle. But you remember, these were built in the Roman times. So in Lancaster, the next city to me, it was built on Roman and Norman. We've got a castle there that's got a moat and a drawbridge. And it used to be turned into a prison, but it's now back to a tourist place. So, yeah, it's very interesting. One little story that I loved about going to Arkansas, you couldn't get Cadbury's chocolate or anything like that back then because the supermarkets didn't carry all this international stuff. So I'm in a tiny little village, and I go into the local garage family store, and there I see two big Cadbury's chocolate raisin bars. So I picked them up and went and paid for them, and I was just delighted because I bought a little bit of home. So on the way back, I'm thinking, I'll share these with my friend Mary. Now, Mary was from Scotland, and one of the things she missed was Cadbury's bars. So I'm going home. I arrive home. On the way home, I am breaking a piece off. Get a few more miles, break another piece off, till finally I get back to Memphis or Millington, and there's only wrapping paper. So I call my friend Mary, and I said, Mary, guess what? And she said, where have you been? I've been looking for you all day. And I said, well, I went into Arkansas, And I said, I found Cadbury's raisin bars. And she went, what? And I said, yeah, your favorite. She said, oh, come on over right now. I said, well, unfortunately, I ate them on the way home. 2 o'clock in the morning, my telephone rings. And I groggily answered it. And it's Mary. She said, if you can't sleep this evening, you should be ashamed of yourself. Because I am still awake thinking about those Cadbury's chocolate bars. So if I can't sleep, you can't sleep. And then she puts the phone down. So I have wonderful, wonderful memories of Memphis. It was delightful. I would go garage sailing all over the place and Germantown and the other affluent areas of Memphis had terrific yard sales. For a Navy wife, it was a wonderful experience. And then downtown itself, these beautiful, like antebellum homes, they were just gorgeous. I stayed in them a couple of nights because the theater owned a couple of them. And because of the shot ice, I had to stay overnight because my wheels wouldn't even spin off the car park. So it was an experience to be able to sleep in those. And I just bless the people of Memphis and that area. They were so gracious, so kind. It's a wonderful 4 years.
Do you remember anything about leaving Memphis for California? What was your, you know, dad got orders to Coronado. How were you more looking forward to California and sad about leaving Memphis, or were you excited? How were you feeling when you...
Well, I was always sad wherever I left because it was such an experience. I first came to Jacksonville in Florida and left there with a heavy heart, went up to Memphis, left there with a heavy heart because I'd made so many friends. On the way to California, we went through many, many states. We didn't go straight across. We kind of zigzagged up and down. Saw Old Faithful, which was a wonderful sight. And we would just enjoy camping. Went through Las Vegas, came down from the mountain or the hills during the night, and it looked like a jewel in the desert. And so I came in. And we drove the streets at night, never really stopped. We camped. And I had a player piano at the time. So I went into Liberace's shop. And his brother was in there. And so I told him I had a player piano. And were there any recordings that he had actually put works on a player piano? Well, while I was in there, I bought several rolls or scrolls. And I was really telling him about my best friend in England. Another best friend. And she was a piano teacher, and she always had two pictures of Liberace on top of her piano. And
that would be Auntie Rini, right?
That would be Auntie Rini. And she'd always tell her pupils in England, now, if you practice hard enough, you'll be able to play like Liberace. She didn't go with the big composers or the classicals. She always said Liberace because at that time, he was a big influence on the entertainment scene in Britain with his flamboyant costumes and everything. So I was telling his brother about this, and he said, would you wait here a minute? And he disappeared, and he came back about 10 minutes later with two signed autographed photographs. And they were signed to Rini. And so I sent them off to Rini. And so the current photographs got replaced by the ones with his signature on. And she'd still but she'd tell them different. She'd say, I'm a friend of Liberace. So I'm going to tell him how you are practicing or not practicing the piano.
You always have the gift of being at the right place at the right time with the right attitude for this sort of thing.
I think so. I think I'm God blessed because he always puts an adventure in my way, and I just lean into it. It's there. Just accept it and go with the flow.